We might as well get off on the right foot, because I am not a any kind of a authority on how to handle money, and I've discovered in the last year particularly that I'm basically a learner. That I've been struggling in the areas of finances a number of years. Those of you who don't know me, I'm a farmer, and I do handle a few dollars. And I find the great secret to farming is not how much money you handle, but how much you've got left over. And I find that to be very difficult in every operation that I get involved in. And I could tell you of, well, we'll get into our study, and then maybe I'll give you a share of some of the experiences that I've had. But before we start in, we ought to pray, because I think that handling money is a spiritual matter. And I think that one of the great problems today in society is a lot of people don't realize that finances is a spiritual matter. And I know a lot of people try to put money over here and spiritual life over here, and, you know, they kind of get them all separated. But I don't find that to be true. And I think it's one and the same. Now, I did give you a little handout, and we're going to be basically talking about some of the principles that I have there. And I'd like to be able to cover some of the material so that you get a general idea. This is not, I just put this together. In fact, this is my first experience. I've been a Christian a number of years. I've never tried to come up with any kind of a handout before, and it'll be obvious when you look it over. And so when you take it along with you, remember that that is not an inclusive study of any kind. It's merely some guidelines and some ideas that the Lord has given me and I've set forth there. And it may be of some help to you in an area or two if you'd like to take a look at it. But so before we go any further, we should take just a minute and ask the Lord's blessing upon our time together. Now, Lord, we just pray as we look into a subject of finances, the Spirit of God would guide us and that we'd be willing to be taught this morning. Help us to come with an open mind, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Luther used to say that a man needs a threefold conversion. That of his head, that of his heart, and then his pocketbook. And you know, I think he may be right. That's just about what we need. That reminds me of a young fellow who came home from school and he said, the teacher was telling us today that Mr. Jones over here, our neighbor, is a financial genius. And he was telling his dad all about that, and he said, I'm not sure about this. What did she mean by that? And his dad thought a minute, and he said, why, what he meant by that was that he could earn money faster than his family could spend it. And so maybe as a result of this, maybe we could become a financial genius and learn how to make money faster than we could spend it. And probably the time together, we're going to be dealing a lot with the idea of spending money. In Luke 12:15, it seemed to me there where Jesus said, take heed and beware of covetousness, that there's kind of a double-barreled warning about covetousness. And you know, I've thought of that verse a number of times, and then I've taken a look back over my own life, and I thought, okay, Lynn, how many times have you ever confessed that as sin? And you know, it's kind of rare, really. I hardly ever found a time when I thought, uh-oh, that's sin. I'm coveting, and I need to confess that before God. So one of the great dangers, but I think amongst other things, that we're talking here about attitudes and about motives. I think Jesus is talking about attitude. And in Napoleon Hill's, one of his latest books, he lists the nine motives of life. And the first three motives, many people feel, are the controlling factors in the world today. And they are the desire, or the emotion of love, the emotion of sex, and the desire for material gain. Now, there may be truth in that. There may be some question as to whether or not those are the strongest motivations, but I think the motive of material gain is a very strong one. And I don't think that we as Christians are exempt from that, Nor do I think that that is necessarily wrong, but I do believe that God wants that to be brought under the control of the Spirit of God. So in order to cover this subject, we're going to take a look at that little handout I gave you, and if for nothing else, it'd be good scratch paper to write on. And I thought we'd just cover this thing as I have it set forth here. I may add a few things or share a few experiences, and then I'd like to take the last 20 minutes just to give an opportunity to discuss what we've talked about, because I know there are always a lot of questions and people have specific needs. It'll be impossible to meet them all, but we want to talk about it. Number one, I have here to start with that money is a medium of exchange. And I've noticed something about finances. The great difficulty is money, we view it in the wrong perspective. Now you see there's $2, and if I put the $2 alongside of this little Living Proverbs, let's say that costs $2, and I put it up here, which would you rather have? And which do you consider as money? Now most people immediately would grab for the $2. And fact is, they would protect that. I've noticed myself that if you lose a quarter, you'd spend 30 minutes looking for it, you see. But you wouldn't think of spending 30 minutes, you see, looking for a pen or something else of a quarter's worth of value. But, Mike, really, what is the difference? There's very little difference. The only difference is that since that is a medium of exchange, I can also get a book, but I can also get other items with it. But basically, it's one and the same. The next one I had down there is money represents life in that you exchange certain number of hours for a certain number of dollars. So in that respect, money actually represents life. And another great principle of help is to remember that you're giving a certain number of hours in return for the object that you're after. Now let's just suppose that we're back to the book again for $2, and let's say that I earn $4 an hour. That means that I'm willing to expend 30 minutes of my life in exchange for that book. That's really what money's all about. And that helps a lot in your spending to always put it back in that perspective. So every item, if you think of it in the perspective of what that's costing you in the way of time, that helps enormously. Am I willing to give that much of my life for that particular object? And so in that regards, money represents life. The third thought is that it takes more skill to get rid of money wisely than it does to earn it, or it does to acquire it. And the amazing thing here is that what do we spend all our time at? Well, we spend all our time developing the skill to acquire it. We spend practically no time developing the skill, you see, of getting rid of it wisely, or spending it wisely, if you'd like to put it in that way. Because you see, money, when it is held, is actually, it's worth a zero. Money in the pocket isn't worth anything. You can't eat it, you can't ride in it, you can't wear it. You see, it's only when it is given out for goods and services that it really has any value. Then the next point is that God's word is to be used as a practical guide in everyday handling of money. And of course, Joshua 1:8, Luke 16:8 are some very good guidelines. Now I think in Joshua 1:8, when it talks about the book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein, for then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, and then thou shalt have good success. I believe that is talking about your finances as well as every other area of your life. And I've had a lot of people try to separate that. But I don't think that's true. Because I think meditating on the Word of God, you're in essence, what you're doing, you're relating the principles of God's Word to everything you do in life, including handling of your money. And the Bible has much to say about the handling of your finances, and therefore it's a spiritual matter. And if you'll learn to live according to those guidelines, you'll find a drastic change in your ability to handle money. And I trust that we'll talk about some of that as we get along. And then, of course, the next thought was that you will manage your money only when you realize it belongs to God and you are the steward. Sometimes a great weakness amongst people who get in the Lord's work is that they lose sight of this thing, and they lose sight of the stewardship responsibility. Many of us do that. In Psalms 24:1, the earth of the Lord is in the fullness thereof. You see, the whole thing belongs to God. And if you ever get the right perspective that this is God's created universe and the whole thing is His, the printing presses, the paper is put on, and all the rest, it's just money. It is stewardship. It's all God's. So it is a responsibility we have to handle that which He's given us. And we'll talk about that some as we get along. I think the next thought possibly is an important thought. Maybe we'll just take a quick look at Luke 19:17. It's the profit motive is honest, legitimate, and scriptural for a Christian. Now, I don't know the young people necessarily have that problem, and I notice a lot of Christians, particularly down in middle life, they're not so sure whether the profit motive is a legitimate motive, but I believe very truly that it is. And here we have the in Luke 19, where we have this parable of the 10 pounds. And in verse 17, he says, "And he said unto him, Well done, thou good servant, because thou hast been faithful in a very little, have thou authority over 10 cities. So here these men had been given responsibility of money. They were, a couple of them were able to increase the value of it by wise investments, and they were commended for that ability to do that. And I think there are many other passages that give us the same principle, that the profit motive is an honest, legitimate, and scriptural motive for a Christian to possess. And I think the next thought comes out of basically the same one, is the ability to make money with money helps to qualify a person for leadership. It is very interesting in this portion that in going on down in the next couple of verses, "And the second came, saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 5 pounds. And he said unto him also, Be thou also over 5 cities. It's interesting that his ability to take that money and invest it wisely and to increase the value of it put him in a position of responsibility over 10 cities, or actually ended up supervising people. And I think there's a scriptural principle here. You learn to handle your money, and you're going to get greater responsibility just in the area of managing not only finances, but managing people. Then I just some ideas of where we stand. Over the years, I've been doing some reading on the subject, and most men who do any writing say that 9 out of 10 people are financial failures. That means in a group this size, there's not too many of us have too good a success with finances. Most of us struggle with it. 9 out of 10 people are financial failures. The average family has a financial emergency every 2 years. And I've discovered that to be true in my life. I've had some financial emergencies I couldn't believe in the farming business. In fact, it hasn't been too many years ago, and we were packing our suitcases. I thought I was all through. I thought I was going bankrupt. I thought I'd had it. I mean, financial emergency, can't believe it, what could happen. And it was, that's some of the times when God really began to deal with me on this area of finances and to get this thing in its proper control. But that's, I found that to be very true, having worked with some people in the last few years on how to handle their money. The next one says, preachers as a group are the world's poorest credit risk. Well, that's quite of a shocking thing. But you can go into any credit bureau in any city, and that's the information they give you. They say, well, now, preachers are the poorest credit risk in the community. Now, we're not here to pick on preachers and so forth, but I just wanted to point this out because I think there's a reason for that. And we're going to talk about that as soon as I give you the next point. Missionaries, school boards, governmental bodies, and all who handle money they themselves did not earn, I mean through a job, daily work, have a reputation of using poor judgment in the spending of that money or the money that was entrusted to them. You see, there seems to have a definite correlation between money that is earned through hard work and money that comes in from other sources. So I believe very strongly that those of you who are going to go into the Lord's work or be supported by other people or get involved in any of these organizations who handle money in which you yourself did not earn, I think it takes a greater responsibility and takes more effort to handle that money successfully than it does for those who go out and earn it through a daily job. And because of the next statement, money you earn through constructive work is the money most likely to benefit you. And I was talking with Jane when we came in, and she was telling me about her home life and where she came from. We're discussing her financial condition. And there's no question, but it was directly related to her bringing up. You see, and I have that same experience. When I was growing up as a young fella, I lived in poverty. I didn't know that until they told me about it. But I remember what a shock it was when I was going to a junior high school in those days in California. I was about the eighth grade, and I got called into the principal's office about 3 or 4 days before Thanksgiving, and he said to me, you've been chosen with two others out of this school to go to a Thanksgiving dinner. And, well, I couldn't put that together what the reason was, and I found out later because I was a poverty lad, and I had no idea that I was living in poverty. But, see, I count that at this point to have been a great privilege to come up in a home in which we didn't have all the things and all the money handed to me. I had to learn when I was young. And I think it's held me in good stead. It's taught me how, you see, to use money, because I've had to use it from constructive work, and that's excellent. The next thought is, a man who makes a big splash is a man who's gone overboard in his spending. And I think that's a fantastic guideline in every area of life. You know, how do you operate? If you have to make a big splash, you've got to make a big show with whatever you're doing, you've gone overboard. So if you go down to buy a car, what is the main concern? Is it to make the splash, or is it to get some wheels under you so you can go do something? It's amazing. And we're not exempt as Christians, you know. We get down and we start to look it over, and we look around, and what's the first thing that catches our eye, see? Well, that's a sleek beauty over there, and it's got the right color, and we like the lines, and besides that, nobody else has got one quite like it. You see, our thinking goes down that direction. So you need to examine in every area of your life, what are you really trying to do? Then the next one is an extremely important one. Financial success does not depend on wishing. It depends on planning. And we're not going to look at those verses right now, but there's some scripture for you. Proverbs 24, 34, Proverbs 27, 23, and 24. That is probably the key to this whole thing. Financial success does not depend on wishing. It depends on planning. And then the next one is the idea that wealth draws people. If you've got money, you're going to have a certain amount of friends. The more money you get, the more friends you're going to have in regards to that money. You just can't get away from it. Too high? Quote friends. Okay, right, basically. And I'm not going to take the time to talk about that in Luke 16 because we've got too many areas I want to cover on the practical aspects of money. But it causes people to hang around you when you've got money. Next one is honesty. Requirements in handling finances. There's not even any use of going into the handling of your finances, your stewardship, unless you get down and deal with these basic areas of honesty. Now you say to me, well, now why would you even be including that portion when we're dealing with Christians? Well, I don't know about you, but I've been a Christian a few years, and you know what my basic problem is? Yeah, I have a tendency to want to be dishonest. Proverbs 3:3, you have to be truthful and kind. Proverbs 11:1, Lord hates cheating. Proverbs 19:1, better to be poor than dishonest. It's interesting in Proverbs 20:21 that it also gives us a very interesting statement. It says money can be made by cheating. Now there's a consequent goes along with it, and it also warns you about what will happen as you do that. And then Proverbs 20:23, Lord hates dishonesty. Well, now I've known that for years. And I remember a couple of years ago when I was heading off to a navigator conference, and I had my youngest son with me. He and I, we stopped at a restaurant to eat on the way to the conference, and we went in and ate, and the meal was kind of poor, and the service was kind of poor, and I didn't think it was too good, and we got ready to leave, and I plunked down a $10 bill, and the gal gave me change for 20. And she said, that's right, isn't it? And I said, yeah, that's right. And I walked out in the car, and we just started to get in the car, and I sat down, and I looked at my youngest son, and I said, boy, that's not right. I know that's not right. That's just a lie. That's as dishonest as I could be. I said, I can't go another... there's no use going. I got to go back in and tell her I lied to her. So So I went back in and told her, and she was flabbergasted. You know, I said, that's really not true. That was a lie. So I just gave her the money, the $10, and went back in my car. And I thought, well, now that ought to solve that problem. I'll never have that difficulty again. Well, just this last year, remember back just a couple months ago, I was taking out some of the kids in our area and in our ministry team, four of us, and we went to a restaurant, and almost the identical thing happened. We were sitting there, and the service was poor and poor, but this time, some young lady couldn't figure, and she had a bill of about $12 for four of us that had a $4, $5 plate. It should have been well over $20, I remember. You know, so the first thing that went through my mind, see, poor service, poor place. Too bad she made a mistake. You know, and so the battle goes on. Is that the way I'm going to operate? Well, praise the Lord, you know, that I'm learning. So I said, no, I can't do that. And so I confessed that as sin to everybody and said, no, I had to wait almost 10 minutes. I said, well, now the girl's going to get in trouble, her boss is going to chew her out. You know how all the excuses go through your mind, you know, and think, well, and I don't want to get her in trouble. Maybe I just let it go, you know. But I said, no, whatever it costs. So I waited about 10 minutes and finally got the young lady who was so busy, and I said, you've made a drastic mistake on the check. And she was very embarrassed and all, but we got it all straightened out. This is a battle. There's going to be a battle the rest of your life. But whenever it comes up, you're going to have to face it. And you need to come through and face it honestly. And when you have a tendency to cheat, and I could tell you all the things that come up in my life in farming business and the opportunity, because that's just the way the world lives. I mean, the farmers around me, that's a game they play with. The cannery, and I raise peaches, and with the almond industry, and everything I do is a big game of kind of slipping it around and cheating and all kinds of ways. But God hates dishonesty. And you'd think I'd learned that thing permanently, but I got a hunch I'm gonna have to deal with that some more. It's not over yet. Common failures according to Scripture. I don't want to take the time for look all these verses up, because if we do, we're not going to get a chance to cover what I want to cover. Gambling income disappears fast. So if you have a tendency to like to make it from rolling dice or playing cards or whatever betting on things, that kind of income, you'll never be able to hang on to it. And I remember as a young fellow back in the military when I was aboard ship, every time there was payday, I was back in the Second World War. I was aboard an aircraft carrier. But every time payday came, you could bank on one thing. There'd be a crap game going on the floor of that compartment like you just couldn't believe. There'd be 50 or 100 guys gathered around there, and the money was so big, and coming from a poverty-stricken family, my eyes would get that big around looking at that. And they'd be rolling dice for $1,000 in a roll. And there was about two guys, I don't know if they had loaded dice or what they did, but there's about two guys that almost invariably would come out of that thing with $5,000 or $10,000. I couldn't believe it. But you know, a year and a half aboard that aircraft carrier and seeing these guys just handling that stuff I couldn't believe, neither one of them was able to handle that money. It always just, it's amazing how easy it could get away from them. You'd think they'd become wealthy. But the principle, see, in Proverbs, you can't get away from it. Next one is, a common failure is you're not teachable. See, there are three responses to this topic right here. Some of it just kind of mock. It's, oh, you know, I've heard that before, and I've got my money under control. There's another response, can be the idea, well, I'll think that over. Maybe I'd be interested in that. Those are what I just call procrastinators. See? Always want to put off making decisions. And there's other people who say, you know, I realize that my own financial needs, I've got some help. I need some help. And that makes sense, and I'm going to put something into practice. But not teachable. I find that when you start talking about person's pocketbook, there's an awful lot of people who are not teachable. And that comes very readily. I got to move on. I wasn't going into some of these things. Next one is Proverbs 21:17, the love for pleasure, plush accommodations, sports, so forth, and so on. It seems to me that to keep this thing in balance, you've got to have a budget. You've got to have a plan. You've got to know what you're going to spend for this area of your life, or it gets out of control on you. We'll talk about that a little later. Taking advantages of others. Freeloaders. Oh, I could give you story after story. I remember one young fellow lived with me one time. He was an officer in the Air Force, and he think he made $1,100, $1,200, and he'd just give it all away. And he was living with me. So we'd get in the car, and we'd go someplace with the servicemen. We'd go to a conference or something. You'd come to a bridge. You'd need to pay a toll. You need to have some money for gas. Guess what? Never had any money. And he thought that was being very spiritual. Well, I don't. See, I think he's a freeloader. I think he's a taking advantage of others. That's not taking a responsibility. That's shirking it. Now, that's the extreme on one side. Most of the time, the extreme is on the other side. And I've got a party right now, a young lady, that does the same thing. She's been around our ministry for 2 years, makes $700 to $800 a month, and she's a freeloader like I've never seen. She just does not carry her own responsibility. She lead at our table, ride in our car, live in our home, but never does anything materially to replace that. She's a freeloader. Taking advantage of others is a common failure. And by the way, she doesn't know how to handle her money. She isn't in any shape financially because you'll never get there with these kind of attitudes. Wrong motives toward finances, Proverbs 23, 1 through 9. The next one, Proverbs 23, 19 through 20, association with free spenders. That's another one. Those with a plan cannot be easily influenced, but you associate with free spenders, and guess what? That's right. The most difficult times I have with my own pocketbook is when I'm around people who are free spenders. Because there's a great strong urge to follow. And it seems like that there's a pride involved. I suppose it's pride probably more than anything else. But the willingness to say to that person, well, I'd like to, but in my budget, you know, I've decided I can't go any further in that area. I got to back off. That $4 steak or, you know, the extra trip over to Disneyland or whatever it might be. You know, I've got to draw the line. And my budget's been expended for recreation this part of the year, and no further. I have to quit at that. We need to learn to take a stand. But if you have the idea there is if you have a budget, you see, or a plan, then you're not easily influenced because you know where you stand and what you want to do. 28:14, trying to get rich quick, common failure. Proverbs 38:9, failure to keep money in its proper balance, meeting needs, not greed. Something that I didn't include in here is an interesting fact, if you like facts, is that I understand that 80% of the widows in the U.S. today go through their inheritance within 18 months. And the reason that I wanted to bring that up is because I think that in handling money or handling finances, when you get into a marriage relationship, those of you who are not married, both parties want to learn how to handle money and grow together. But almost invariably, in most relationships that I've ever seen, it's always one or the other. Either a man brings home the paycheck and plunks it down, and his wife picks it up and pays all the bills and takes care of all the finances and delves him out a little allowance, or he brings it home and he delves it out. And he says, okay, you can have so much for groceries and so much for this, and so forth. But that is not scriptural at all. And over in Ecclesiastes, two are better than one, it teaches. So you need to grow together. And if our gals have any question about their need to learn to handle finances, you just want to study Proverbs 31. See, there's a picture of a godly gal. She not only can handle finances, but she understands business as well. And understands the business aspect of it, which is a much greater responsibility than just handling your personal finances at home. Common sense must. We must take financial inventory. Remember that this thing just does not happen. You must take financial inventory. And I would trust that, you know, before a day goes by, if nothing else, flip the sheet over on the back of it, take financial inventory. Where do you list your assets and list your liabilities? What do I owe and what have I got? You have to take financial inventory. You'll never have any idea or you'll never get control of your money. We must remember we all have a strong tendency to overspend. And I wish I could put that stronger. But that's the issue right there. We all have a strong tendency to overspend. We must operate with a plan. We must develop sales resistance. And a good principle there is allow yourself a cooling off period in sales resistance. If you got some desire for something, you want to go buy it, give yourself some time to cool off on it, particularly any major thing. Now, I'm not talking about going down and buy a loaf of bread. I'm talking about if you want to buy an automobile, you can buy some furniture, or maybe if you're going to buy an expensive coat, give yourself a cooling off period. It's an interesting thing in the state of California that when you go now to get a loan for real estate and other things, the state finally stepped in and forced all lending agencies to give you a 2-day cooling off period. Isn't that interesting? So that forced people to go home and think it over after some salesman's put the pressure on them. And my dad helped me with that years back. He told me on any major item, Len, he said, give yourself a 7-day cooling off period. If you're going to go buy an automobile, you're going to buy a piece of land, you're going to buy anything major, you know, give yourself a cooling off period. And I found that's been very helpful. The first day goes by and you still think you want it bad, and the second day is not quite so bad, and the third day you just back off. And a lot of times by the time the seventh day has gone around, you think, oh, how dumb. That's the last thing I really needed. You see? A great help to do that. We must list all the small expenses and eliminate many of them. Now, I'm not necessarily a penny pincher down to the penny, but you can just, you can't imagine sometimes how much money gets away from you on the Coke machine. You know, it's just amazing. You go down the hall and there's that Coke machine, it's a quarter. You know, well, it's a quarter this morning and it's in a quarter this afternoon, and you go down the next place and it's another quarter, and first thing it's a dollar and a half a day, $2 a day. So here we're going to take a little study on Proverbs, and I broke it into what I think just four simple steps. That doesn't mean that's the best way. You may want six or eight steps, but I've broken into four steps for a reason, because it's easy for me to share it with you. But I feel very strongly that the first step must be the first priority, and that's giving. Proverbs 3, 9, and 10. The first step in handling your finances is always to learn to give. If you're a new Christian, you're wondering what to do with your finances, the first thing you have to do is learn to give. If you're going to help somebody, it's the same answer. You'll have to learn to give. And I give a couple of reasons why I thought that was true. One of them is, it helps you deal with the major problem of your character, and that is selfishness. So you learn to give, and you begin to get rid of some of that selfishness that's down deep in your soul. That's just the way we're made. We human beings are all the same. We think of ourselves. And so that's very important to learn to give first. Another thing it should do for you, it helps in financial planning. For many people who learn to give, that is the first time in their life they've ever taken stock of themselves financially as to what they could do. So maybe they haven't sat down and had a plan, but they got a plan in their mind. They say, okay, I'll be able to give $10 a week or $20 a month. So it's a plan. It's a first stage in development. Then I think there's a second stage of giving. We're not going to talk long about giving. That's in Proverbs 11, 24 and 25. And I think that's sacrificial giving. And I think that's also what is known as the law of compensation. And it's interesting that men of the world recognize that principle. And well, I've got some books, and some of these men of the world are really sharp when it comes to handling finances. And I've really enjoyed this one by Napoleon Hill. He has a, some of you read a lot know that Napoleon Hill has had a very well-known book out, Think and Grow Rich. He has a newer one out that is, I have listed in here, that's Grow Rich with Peace of Mind. And I have a copy of it with me. Grow Rich with Peace of Mind. And in there he has a chapter on this law of compensation, which is nothing more than learning to give. That everything you have, you need to learn, your whole lifestyle needs to be in the area of giving. And it's interesting to me that even this fellow Emerson, and I don't know much about him except that he never did excite me too much, he has an entire book out on the principle of law of compensation. And sometimes some of these worldly men get a better grip on some of God's principles than we Christians do. And I think that's a shame. But it happens sometimes. Other reasons. In helping the poor, you're lending to the Lord. Proverbs 19:17. Then I have hard work and giving go hand in hand. Proverbs 21:25 and 26. And maybe Proverbs 13:19 ought to be included in that. The desire accomplished is sweet to the soul. And I found many people never really experienced Proverbs 13:19. And then generosity and happiness go hand in hand, Proverbs 22:9. Okay, I wanted to get away from that and get on to some other aspects of handling money. The second step, as you can see I have here, is working your way out of debt. I wish I'd have put the reference up there alongside of the second stage here. Working your way out of debt, Proverbs 3:27 and 28. Don't withhold repayment of your debt. Don't say some other time if you can pay now. Credit. Credit buying could be the major factor as to whether you end up with a nest egg or a goose egg. Burdens of credit. Proverbs 22:7. The rich control the poor. You see, there's nothing that people who operate businesses like better than to get you you see, on their credit system. Why is it when you go into these stores that they're so anxious to put you on their credit system? Because they like it. It's the control over you. You see, they control you. The rich control the poor. The lender has say to the borrower. And they soon control you. They like that. Charge accounts are usually an obstacle to success with money. Now, I tried to be very nice about that. I think sometimes I should be a little stronger about that. I should say, probably always are an obstacle to success with money, instead of usually. Number three, credit cost money. Sears Roebuck makes more money on revolving credit than they do on the markup on their merchandise, and they have for years. That's where they make their money. That's why they're so anxious to get you signed up with their credit department, along with all the rest of those stores. Now, credit really does cost you. Take a look at the next page, and just take a look at what credit, the debt trap cost you. I thought you'd be very interested in that, and I just took that out of one of the books that I've been studying. If you went into debt at the rate of $1,000 a year at the end, and the interest rate at 10%, at the end of 15 years, your total indebtedness would be $34,000. Isn't that interesting? More than double of the amount of money that you had put into that indebtedness. Now, to repay the debt in approximately the same length of time it took to accumulate it at $1,000 per year, it takes an annual payment of $4,000 a year. Then you could be out of debt in 16 and a half years. It's amazing if you really get a good look at it. Now, one of the great problems with finances and indebtedness and credit is that it is so obscure. These people who deal with finances, that is a field all by itself. And credit is a very, very elusive thing to really understand what it's costing you. There are so many ways to figure interest rate that it would take us 2 or 3 hours just to discuss a few of them. There are many, many ways. And the reason they use so many ways is to fool you so that you really don't get the picture of what it's costing you. And before we get through, we'll talk about financing on cars and what the interest rate is. And invariably, I don't think I've ever put a session on where somebody didn't come to me afterward and say, well, you know, I got an interest rate a lot cheaper than that. Last time I gave a session, some young guy came up to me and said, oh, I'm only paying 5% on my car. Interesting how that they could deceive him to think that he's only paying 5% interest on his automobile. There hasn't been any 5% simple interest for years. That's been gone almost before my time. But he was deceived into thinking that's what he was paying. All right, back to that. We don't want to spend much time on this because I'm just going too slow. Number four on that bottom of that page we just left was, do not go into debt on depreciating items. And if you'd like to underscore something, you can underscore that. Do not go in debt on depreciating items. What is a depreciating item? Food, clothing, automobiles, furniture, appliances, on and on and on. See, that's depreciating. The value of it goes downhill. And anything where the value of it goes downhill, don't go in debt on that. By the way, I am talking about your personal finances. I am not talking about business. Because business is a completely different operation that is separate from this, your personal finances. And since we have a very limited time, and most of you are not really that interested in business at this stage anyway, I felt there's no need to try to go into any business principles. So these are personal finances we're talking about. Some sensible indebtedness. Real estate is a sensible indebtedness. It has been for years and probably will continue to be. Because you have to live someplace. You can buy a home in many cases, and you find that you actually build up a little equity. But there needs to be discernment. Education. It could be a sensible indebtedness. I say use wise discernment. And I was talking with this young lady about this area. Now, I know some people who went into indebtedness and for education, and it was of great value because, in a sense, it was not depreciating. It helped them to increase their earning power down through the years, and they more than got their return on their investment. Although I know a number of young ladies who have also went in debt for their education, and it was a fatal mistake. I know two of them that are suffering today. They've been out of college a number of years. The degree they got is not helping them at all in getting a job, so they've had to go get a job that anyone could get out of being graduate from high school, and here they've got this huge indebtedness. And it's going to take years to get out of that indebtedness. So it can be a great danger. So you need wise discernment on indebtedness when it comes to education. Now, I put down techniques for getting out of debt. Now, that's kind of an interesting word, because the techniques for getting out of debt or handling finances is almost ruthless. That's just what it amounts to. It is just a ruthless process if you want to get out of debt. It's not. It's nothing. You don't come with any nice flowery ideas you pick out and all of a sudden everything changes. It's just hard grinding out process. Here's what it is. Number one, have a credit card burning ceremony. Boy, just get yourself, build yourself a little altar and get yourself a match and have a little ceremony and burn the whole shooting match up and get rid of it. Number two, no new purchases without cash. Just make it a standing rule. Number three, list all debts in order of priority. One, two, three, four, in the order of priority. What do you think is most important? Second most important, third most important, fourth most important. You've got to sit down. You've got to do it. And if you say, well, I can't figure it out, you stay right there and you figure it out. And decide what really is most important. Then there are some possibilities. Sell items of indebtedness. That becomes ruthless, and most people don't want to part with items. Number five, refinance into one payment is a possibility. And number six, get wise counsel. Now, I was working with a young couple. We started about a year ago. They were about $12,000 in debt, and they wanted their life to count for God, and they would have been with the Navigators today had they not been in debt. So they were anxious to get out of debt. These two, this young couple, he makes $1,200 a month. They have no family, but they are $12,000 in debt. So I went through those very same principles with them, and you know we've put every one of those into practice, and by this, the first of the year, 1 year they're going to get out of debt. Amazing. Have a credit card burning ceremony, that's the first thing we did. We sat down and they had credit cards like you couldn't believe. Every place you went, they had a credit card. And really had a bonfire. It was terrific. The next one is very painful. No purchases without cash. Because in order to get rid of the joke and debt, that's painful. Once you get on the indebtedness side, it is twice as tough to get back on the cash side as it would have been if you'd have started over there. So be very careful. If you're not in that trap in indebtedness, don't get in that. Because what you have to do, you have to concentrate all your finances on the indebtedness, and then you're living on practically nothing. And there is no other way out of it in order to get yourself out of debt, because you want to get over on the cash basis side. The next thing we did was sell out of indebtedness. They had a second car. They had a second car. First thing we did is get rid of that thing. Well, we're going to take a $200 loss. No, you're not taking a $200 loss. Not on the slightest. You wouldn't be taking a loss if you gave it away. Get rid of the joking thing. Whatever you can get out of it and get out from underneath it. You got no more insurance. You got no more license. You got no more tires. You got no more batteries. You got no more gas. You eliminate that whole process. Now, most of us don't like to deal with things like that. But you see, that's what it requires if we're going to get a hold of this thing in our finances. The next one, get wise counsel. Find somebody who's really seems to be able to handle their money and get with them. And if I was a young lady, and I knew this particular young lady I talked to in here, you know where I'd go for counsel? I'd go talk to her. She's got some, God's been teaching her how to handle her money. And she used to have a car, and right today she doesn't even have an automobile. She makes good money. She's probably got more reason to drive a car than most of us in here. But she doesn't. But I believe she responded to God in the area of getting rid of that joking thing until she gets herself on top of herself financially. And my boys have done that basically the same thing. My two boys are in business for themselves. And they operated without a car for a long period of time. And then they finally got some vans, and that was they were using that as their transportation while they were in business. Now they've got themselves some cash. They were able to go out and purchase an automobile. Now they're back in. They've got one between the two of them. But you see, there are a lot of answers to this thing financially. Okay, spend wisely. Proverbs 10:16. A wise man, by the way, these are all out of the Living Series. A wise man, no, it's not a wise man. Right now she went blank. I'll have to look it up. A good man's earnings, like this coming to me. A good man's earnings advance the cause of righteousness, but a foolish man an evil man squanders his on sin. A good man's earnings advance the cause of righteousness. All spending directed towards that which builds righteousness, Proverbs 10:16. That's a principle of stewardship. Wise spending. And we were talking a little bit about automobiles, so here we go. Automobiles. The desire for a new car is strong, particularly for servicemen and young people, students and so forth. Very strong desire for a new automobile. And boy, can we justify that thing. We've got so many reasons why we need it. It's just amazing. Because the urge is so strong. Number two, a new automobile or new auto is not the cheapest transportation. It never has been. It probably never will be. But it's amazing how we can justify that. Now, I'm not saying that for some people you should never go buy a new automobile. That's not what I'm saying at all. That depends on your circumstances, your responsibilities in life, where you are in life, and on and on. Now, if someone whose ministry has grown to a point to where their whole life's involved in the ministry, the finances is there, they're prepared, they haven't got time to shop and keep an automobile repaired, maybe they need to go the route of getting something that they can depend on and it's new and so forth. So it depends on, you know, your financial condition. But most of us will go to the extreme of buying that beyond our means. That's the reason why it's a very dangerous area. And do you realize what percentage of a person's income goes for district transportation? Well, for a lot of young people, it gets to be 60 and 70% of their income goes for transportation. It is amazing. But you'll never understand that until you learn to keep records, and we'll talk about that a little later. If you purchase, it should have been a used auto, you escape the heavy first and second year depreciation. Very important principle. Number four, automobiles extend the life of your car is the best way to save on transportation. Extend the life of your car. People will tell you, well, you need to trade it in when it's got 70,000 miles on it or 80,000. And that's not the cheapest way to handle it. If you want to get by the cheapest way, you want to learn to extend the life of that thing. You want to increase the life of your automobile. I remember reading a book by a banker in the East a few years ago. He was not a Christian. He said, how to have more money to spend. And that was his major emphasis was on these areas of life. The great problem is we want to get rid of it too soon. We need to learn how to extend the life of it. And we're going to see that in just a minute as we look at another financial statement here on buying automobiles. In fact, maybe we ought to look at that right now, the next page. Now, this is a little old because I took that out of one of the books I've been reading. What does it cost to drive a car? 72 Chevy Impala, four-door sedan, with some extras on it. You're going to buy it new. Cost $4,700. Trade in for a 1963 Chevrolet, value of $350, $700. Now, isn't that interesting? Whenever you go to buy an automobile from a dealer, you see, he always gives you a nice, beautiful trade-in for your car. That's just standard. So here, you see what it said? The value was $350, but how much did he get for it? $700. You see, they do that because that's a cycle, has a psychological effect on you. You know, here's your bucket of both, and they're giving you twice what you need for it, so immediately that's an urge to move it. They always do that. Net cost, $4,000. Sales tax, $120 total. Now, cost of 36 months average annual cost. Credit life insurance, $44. Interest, $194. Depreciation, $915. Insurance, $213. Total annual cost. Now, this is per year. The cost here is $1,452. Now, your 1963... the old junker, that was back in 72, was 9 years old. Value of $350, tax $18, depreciation $100, insurance $142, total cost per year $260. Your 72 Chevrolet cost annually, first 3 years, it cost you annually for the first 3 years $1,452 or better than $100 a month. The 63 Chevy, if you'd have kept it, your annual 3 years cost would have been $260 a year or less. Actually, it's less is the way I see it because it's only worth $350 to start with, and you had zero when you got through, and usually, no matter how what you do, it's worth something. The available to repair your old car, $1,192. Can you imagine that? You could spend $100 a month to repair your old car. Assume repairs of $500 a year. Your savings is $692. Now, on the other side, briefly. Now, here's the bank way the bank would figure it. So he figures it down for that same automobile and everything. So you run down, you see the cost of the note for 36 months for that car. Credit life insurance, $134, interest, $583, total note due, $44.67. So your payments of 36 months is $124.08. And see, that's what most people are interested in. They say, well, okay, what's it cost me a month to buy the thing? So it's $124. But now look at this. The fixed cost for a 72 Chevy per mile driven. Supposing you drive 15,000 miles a year, it costs you 9.7 cents a mile to drive that thing. It has nothing to do with gas and oil and repairs. Just the fixed cost. So you see, when the government comes along and says that they reimburse business people 12 cents a mile for every mile you drive your car, they're not too far off. That's pretty accurate. It costs an enormous lot of money to drive an automobile. And of course, the more mileage you put on it, the less per mile is that fixed cost. We got to get on. Ooh, I'm not doing so good. All right, we got to move on. Furniture and appliances, many of you are in that or you're not into that position yet. You can buy used or on sale, extend the life of, repairing, refinishing, building. Another principle I didn't put down, I should have, is buy good quality under furniture. I've had some sad experiences buying junk. My son's laughing at me. That's right. But we have really been learning in the last few years how to buy furniture. And the way to buy furniture is buy it used and buy it for a private party. Well, we have come up with some of the most beautiful sofas and furniture you could ever imagine for a fraction of the cost. My wife just bought a living room set a bedroom suite. It's the second one we've had in our lifetime, and the first one was used, and so is this one. But you wouldn't know that. And it would cost over $1,000 to replace it, and I think it cost you something like $200. It's just a beautiful piece of furniture. And the lady that we bought it from was having a custom-made, you see. But these things are available. See, one of the great values of being on cash, whatever you need, automobiles and so forth, all the same. When you have the money, the cash, you can take advantage of these opportunities. Clothing, buy quality and keep the quantity down. Extend the life through proper care. Well, if I could tell you some of the stories of the guys that live with me, how they handle the clothing. It's unbelievable. I remember one young fellow that I led to the Lord one time in my field, and I wanted to help him, and he and his family were really in bad shape. So I bought him a suit at Penny's, and I bought him a new pair of shoes and a white shirt and a tie and so forth, and I wanted to take him to church with me. So I took him to church, and I was pretty proud. You'd never know. He's the same guy. You know what he did the next week with those clothes? I couldn't believe it myself. He went to work in them. He was working in them. Shoes, the pants. No care whatsoever, those things. But the great trap, I think, in clothing is we shoot for quantity. And we could almost talk about these for some time. We need to just really discuss some of these because these are very important. You see, you get your wardrobe through. If you want to do a little checking sometime to see how you're doing in the way of buying when it comes to clothes, just go through your wardrobe and take a look at it. And all that you've got in there and how often you're wearing it, what it costs you, and what you think of it today. Was that a good buy or wasn't it? See, most of the time we won't face up to that issue. And I was just sharing with Roger when I came in. I said to him, I got this blue blazer. I bought it for a purpose because in our Western Division, we were all going to buy the same thing. And I got the thing, and it doesn't fit quite right, and it doesn't look quite right. And I told him, I said, nuts, I'm wearing it. I got a pair of red pants, and I just will not waste it. So here it is. And I'd never necessarily choose the blue blazer, but I'm not about to go out and buy a new one. I got a blue one. So I'll work it out. So whether maybe it doesn't look as sharp as some of the others, but there it is. So I got a red pants to go with it, and maybe it's just my idea. Maybe it looks sharper, better than anything else. But anyway, I wouldn't choose it if I were, you know, purchasing something. Okay, food. We're not going to talk about much, except the item number 4. Make a game out of thrifty spending. That's a very important principle. It has to be fun. Your shopping has to be fun. You have to enjoy it. You have to make a game out of it. If it isn't, you have a hard time controlling all the little expenses. Insurance. We've got to touch briefly on that. I should have put the word is in there instead of that. Is an expense rather than a saving. Insurance is an expense rather than a saving. And in the little box, that fellow's name was Gene War, not Gene Was. Insurance is a poor investment. If you're thinking of insurance as an investment, it's a very poor one. And all men who really know how to handle money will tell you that insurance is a poor investment. Now, we don't have time to discuss these things, but George Bauman, and I have a reason for quoting these men because it puts me off the hook. Decreasing term insurance gives the most protection when needed most and leaves financial freedom to save in a wise investment, by George Bauman. That's his statement. In all the men that I've read who really seem to understand the area of finances will tell you that insurance is a bummer. It is not a good deal. And I don't even like the name of it. I think it's really death insurance. It's not life insurance. You don't get anything out of it while you're living. It's only when you die that they reimburse you. And I don't have time to go into it, but you need to do a little study on that. And I think you're going to see in the next 10 to 20 years in our society, I think you're going to see a change along that line. I think people are going to begin to rebel a little bit at the salesmanship of some of these insurance companies, because they are now controlling the wealth of our country. And it is not coming back out to those of us who pay principals. I mean, to pay or paying in, you see. Something like 20 to 25% of the money that's paid in actually comes back in claims. Less than a fourth. And most of us wouldn't even go to Reno and gamble on that kind of an odds, and yet we'd buy insurance on that kind of an odd. So I think you need to reevaluate that end. But term insurance, after you're married, or if you need to take the responsibility in case something happens to you, we can get you in a box and get you buried, why, maybe you'd like a little term insurance. And I've told the guys that live with me, if they don't want any term insurance, fine. I'll nail the box together, and I got a tree that needs fertilizing. It's amazing how we think when it comes to these things. F, do not become a loan agency. I won't go into that. Proverbs 6, 1 through 5, savings. Proverbs 21, 20, I got to get to that. We don't talk about that much around finances. A wise man saves for the future, but a foolish man spends whatever he gets. You hear a little about that around Christians. Another way maybe you could say that is to operate with a margin. But don't always be spent up. Yes. Proverbs 21, 20. Now, just, I had to come up with some ideas here because I want to impress on you the value of saving. Saving, anyone can save. The effort you make towards saving a percentage of your income gives you a true knowledge of the value of money. Maybe you're only going to handle a little money, but I think it'd be very healthy to learn to save right off the bat. The habit of saving does away with the habit of waste. And I got some of these ideas from many men. Savings is an index of character. It has much to do with a man's sense of purpose and his ability to manage his affairs. And I think we saw that some in Luke. Savings equips you to be in a position to take advantage of many opportunities which otherwise might slip away. We've talked about that briefly. Savings prepares you for giving. The Proverbs 11, 24, and 25 way. More blessings. And I've noticed amongst Christians, amongst missionaries and Christian leaders, there is a strong reluctance to save for some reason. But I think it's very scriptural to do that. Now, briefly, if you'll turn over the next page, you'll see I've got one in there on savings and what it can do for you. You save $1,000 annually at a 6% interest rate, and in 15 years, your ending balance is $24,672.56, and almost doubled. At the end of 15 years, you could start to withdraw $2,000 annually. And at the end of 11 and a half years, drawing $2,000 annually, you still have more money in there than you put in originally. And if you'll notice down at the end of that savings chart, that's knowing is having your money work for you. Now, if you get money in this right perspective, you begin to think, you begin to see that is not always the answer to it to be all spent up. For some reason around the Christian society, we've gotten the idea that it's almost a sin to have any money around anywhere. You know, you just kind of keep getting rid of it. You keep getting rid of it. And I've been around some people that seem to me like it's almost a fetish with them to get rid of what they got. Here they're living on maybe gift income. And it's almost a monthly thing. You just got to get rid of that money. Well, I don't think that is either scriptural honor to God. And I think that could very well be one of the major reasons they're having difficulty with their finances, because I don't think that's good stewardship. Now, I had to throw in the next page. I'm going to get through this somehow. I had to throw in the next page on work, because work and handling your money go hand in hand. And one of the reasons why a lot of people don't have any money is because they're just too joking lazy. And the Bible's got so much to say about that that we might just well communicate it. Just look at it. Proverbs 10:4, lazy end up poor, hard workers get rich. Proverbs 10:26, lazy people are very irritating to their employers. Proverbs 12:11, hard work equals dollars. Proverbs 13:4, lazy people have many wants, they end up with little. Proverbs 13:11, money from hard work grows. You see that? That's the kind of money that develops and increases. Proverbs 19:27, sleep is the enemy of work, or it's the enemy of wealth. You like to rack it out over long periods of time? Well, you're going to pay for that in the end result. Sleep is the enemy of prosperity. Proverbs 21:25 and 26, lazy men long for things, but have little, it said. Proverbs 24:30 through 34, a visual lesson in laziness. In Proverbs 26:13 to 16, lazy men are too smart for their own good. In Proverbs 28:19, hard work equals prosperity. Playing around equals poverty. So you see, it has to do with work. Now, I don't think that necessarily means you work 60 hours or 80 hours or 100 hours a week. That's not the principle. The thing is to learn to be wholehearted about the job when you're on it. And society, employers today are begging for employees who will be wholehearted about their job. Now, I don't think that in a lot of cases you've got to give your life to that. We get the idea that, well, you're going to do that, you've given your life to that, and I don't want to do that. It's more spiritual, you know, to kind of be memorizing verses and praying and carrying on. I don't think the Scripture teaches that at all. I think it's a wholeheartedness about the job at hand. And so if you've got a job for 40 hours a week, if you're the best employee over there and you're really committed to that thing and giving the best effort, you'll be rare, and you're going to get rewarded as a result of that in the end result.